And now let us hear the reading of the Word of God from the book of 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, and I shall begin at the 4th verse. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah. And they said unto him, Behold, thou art now old, and thy sons are not walking in thy ways. So therefore provide for us a king to judge us like all the other nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not be king over them. And according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this very day, in that they have forsaken me, they have served other gods, and they also do this to thee. Now therefore hearken to their voice. Howbeit, thou shalt protest solemnly unto them, and thou shalt show them the manner of king that shall reign over them. And Samuel said to the people all the words of Jehovah when they asked him for a king. And he said, now this is very important, Samuel, by the word of the Lord, is making it clear now to the people what will be their lot if they reject God as their king and ruler and Lord and accept an earthly ruler. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them unto him for his chariots to be his horsemen, and they shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint them some as captains of thousands, captains of fifties. And he will send some to plow the ground, to reap the harvest, to make his instruments of war and the instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters too, to be perfumers and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants, your maid servants, your goodliest young men and your cattle and put them to work for him. He will take the tenth of your flock that you shall be his servants. And you shall cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. And they said, Nay, we want a king to rule over us, that we may also be like all the other nations. And Samuel heard all the words of the people and rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, You hearken to their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, Go ye every man into his own city. This is the third of a series of messages based on the historical books, some of the historical books of the Old Testament. And we've traced now Israel's history up through the period of the judges, where they were, by the gracious gift of God, given judges and magistrates to help them keep order. We remember the importance of this. Sinful people at their best need some sort of restraining force. And so God gave them judges to try to stem the tide and to carry them through this period of lawlessness and covenant breaking. But in this, the children of Israel saw the pomp and ceremony of the neighboring nations, those who were not Israelites, the pagan nations. He saw their parades and their marching down the street with all kind of banners honoring their king and what have you. And all of this pomp and pageantry was very appealing to the Israelites. And so they simply forgot their covenant obligation and said to Samuel, "We want a king like that. We want a man to rule over us." And Samuel, as the text tells us, was greatly distressed because he, in his prophetic insight, saw exactly what would happen. And told the Lord of his misgivings about this plan. The Lord said, "Well, now, Samuel, they have really not rejected you, they have rejected me. Would you go ahead and give them what they want?" Now, my friends, first of all, I want to indicate that this part of the text this morning supports that contention that we have had occasion to discuss at various times, both here and in our Bible study, of the fact that God, in all of His sovereign power and grace and love and mercy and truth, will not trample on the dignity of the free moral agency of mankind. He simply will not do it. He wants you to do right, provides the means for you to do right. This is the way, walk in it. He wants us to be right. He will not make us be right. Dr. Miller at Union Seminary used to call this God's terrible non-intervention. God simply doesn't work that way. He doesn't say, "Now, boy, whether you like it or not, whether you want to be good or not, I'm going to make you be good. I'm going to push this button and see to it that you're good." That was not, that's just not possible. It's not like God. He respects the dignity of our free moral agency, which means, of course, ipso facto, that we are very responsible people. God has blessed us. He has shown us the way, has proved His love, and wants us to have the best. But He will not force His affection or His will on us. I've had occasion to remind you of John Greenleaf Whittier's poem that I've never been able to find the title of. If you all know it, for heaven's sake, tell me so I won't have to beat around the bush anymore. But John Greenleaf Whittier, while not a theologian, was more of a theologian than he knew. And he wrote these words: "Though God be good and free be heaven, not force divine can love compel. And though the song of sins forgiven should sound through lowest hell, the sweetest persuasion of His voice respects the sanctity of your will. He giveth day. Thou hast thy choice to walk in darkness still." And this is something of the experience that Samuel and the Israelites and the Lord had. The people, because they're basically sinful, as we are, have an innate aversion to yielding to the sovereign grace of God. It's just nature for us to say, "We all want you." And God says, "Well, if you don't want me, that'll have to be the way it is. You shall have what you want." But you see, this not only was true in the days of Samuel, it was true, as we say, in the Garden of Eden. When God made mankind, when He talked with Adam — we ought to call him Ish, but we erroneously call him Adam — He said, "Now listen, I want you to be like me. and to be gloriously happy in the right sense. And you will be so if you do this way, walk this way. But if you do this, you're going to be in trouble. You and your posterity are going to be in trouble. But there's no evidence that God took a Tommy gun and said, "Now, I'm just not going to let you do wrong. I'm going to make you do right." He said, "There it is, Adam. The choice is yours." And of course, he made the wrong choice, and we've been paying for it ever since. A lot of people blame it on the female of the species, but I'm going to be more honest and say that if Adam had gotten a chance at that apple first, he would have eaten the whole thing, and Eve wouldn't have had any. But the point that I'm making is that it is a basic and profoundly true theological statement that God loves us and wants the best for us, but will not force it on us. What an awful responsibility this places on us. You remember a story told by Jesus? I forget the name of that parable that is told, the unfaithful steward or something, where the steward leaves the management of his affairs and goes off to another country, but he sends a man to rule over them. And of course, the parable is really talking about Jesus. He was talking about himself. But after the master left to go to the far country, the people say, "We don't want this man to rule over us. We want to do our own thing. We don't want anybody telling us what to do." And my friends, this has been the reason for the downfall of many a person. I remember years ago I was trying to teach at the Charlotte Country Day School. The headmaster hired me. I needed to be hired too. I needed some money. But he hired me and told me that I'd have no problem. Says, "The cream of the crop of the Charlotte hierarchy." Wrong thing. "The cream of the crop of the best Charlotte people are going to have their children in that school, so there'll be no disciplinary problems at all." Well, my friends, I never had so much discipline to try to exert in my life. Every weekend or so, I was getting a call from the father or one or two of some of those people to ask me to help them get their sons and daughters out of jail. It happened that Frank Littlejohn, the chief of police, was a deacon in my church. And I was constantly having to try to intercede to get some youngster out of jail. But now why? The point I want to make is why. I did have problems with the cream of Charlotte society. Why? Because too many of them, not their own fault, their parents' fault, I'm sure, simply were not convinced of the uniqueness of God's moral law. Even then, this was 35 years ago, 30 years ago. They said, "We'll do as we please." The Ten Commandments, why, they may have done for Moses, but not for us. We make our own decisions. And so Israel now wanted to make it her own way without the benefit of the guidance and the love that God stands ready to shower upon the people. "He giveth day. Thou hast thy choice to walk in darkness still." But the next and final thing I want to emphasize is not only that God will not make us, but it's right to emphasize too, as the text does, that God does want us. He is a God of love and has at great price to himself provided every means for our good and for our redemption, for our justification and our sanctification. Yes, he has. And we oftentimes choose our own way. Now, to get quite personal about it, I wonder whether we sometimes are not just as guilty as those Israelites under Samuel. we give lip service too often to our covenant commitments and obligations. We say we love Him, but actually in our hearts we do not want our lives to be lived under the stringent requirement, shall we say, of the moral law. And we've heard, of course, in recent decades or two, the new morality. Now, the new morality may have some perfectly supportable theses to it, perhaps. But basically, the new morality fails to see the uniqueness of New Testament love. If I love you, then I do not want you to do as you please, nor am I willing to let you do as you please. If I love you, I want you to be right under God. New Testament love is always redemptive. It is never a matter of catering to the whims and to the likes of a person. Oh, my child likes this. I know it's not good for him, but I love my child, so I'm going to give this to my child. That's plain stupidity. If we love God, then we love our fellow men. And if we love our fellow men, we want for them the best. Love is not giving another person what he wants, but what we know is best for him. That's New Testament love. And, for example, Fletcher and his sponsoring what's called the new morality fails, in my opinion, to see the basic importance of New Testament agape. It's not to cater to the whims of a person, but at great sacrifice, whatever it takes, whatever it costs, giving that person what is most likely to get him into a proper relationship with God and his fellow man. And I wonder, my friends, whether we do this. I wonder whether, even as individual Christians in this congregation, we sometimes unwittingly are saying, well, we'll do this thing the way we think it ought to be done. We are not referred to what we know to be the moral law or God's will, but we'll make decisions without really consulting Him or without appealing to the requirements of the moral law. Do we love Him? I wonder whether our indifference and our misdirection sometimes make us guilty of really being the world instead of the church. Does God have to use a microscope, a high-powered one at that, to look at this one and that one to see which one belongs to the church and which one to the world? Are our attitudes and actions sometimes, our deeds, our words, our gestures, what we laugh at, what we read, are those things indicative of the fact that we live under the Lordship of Christ, or living on our own? I found this poem, which I remembered years ago, and I'm not going to try to recite it all, but I put a few paragraphs down here, by Matilda Edwards, called The Church Walking with the World. Now, of course, this is simply illustrating the great biblical principle that we, of course, are in the world, unless we move up to Mars, and I don't want to do that. We are in the world, whether we like it or not. But we are straightly charged not to be of the world. We are, in fact, that's what the word church means. From churchy, okay, we belong to the Lord. We're unique, different from the common rabble. And here's the poem. The church and the world walked far apart on the changing shores of time. The world was singing a giddy tune, and the church a hymn sublime. Come, give me your hand, said the merry world, and walk with me this way. But the good church hid her snowy hands and solemnly answered, nay. I will not give you my hand at all, and I will not walk with you. Your way is the way that leads to death. Your words are all untrue. Nay, walk with me just a little space, said the world with a kindly air. The road I walk is a pleasant road, and the sun shines always there. Your path is thorny and rude and crude, but mine is broad and plain. My way is paved with flowers and dews, and yours with tears and pain. The sky to me is always blue, no want, no toil, I know. The sky above you is always dark, your lot is a lot of woe. There's room enough for you and me to travel side by side. That's the devil. Then the sons of the world and the sons of the church walked closely hand and heart. The intervening verses show how that the church slyly said, well, I'll let you hold my hand for a little bit and we'll walk along. Before long, they were kissing and carrying on. The only master who knoweth all can tell the two apart. Then the church sat down at her ease and said, I am rich, and my goods increase. I have need of nothing or ought to do but to laugh and to dance and to feast. And the sly world heard as he laughed in his sleeve and mockingly said aside, the church is fallen, the beautiful church, and her shame is her boast and pride. And my friends, I want to make it very clear, lest I be misunderstood. I am not for a moment pleading for the church to isolate herself from the world. No. But I am saying that we have an obligation to be unique and different. For God's sake, let us stand for something. And let that something be right and true and holy and just. For we mock our religion and do an injustice to God when we are two-faced and hypocritical about our relationship to Him. Yes, Israel was not willing for God to be their ruler. Let us make the rules and call the strikes. And none of us has the wisdom to do that, my friends. None of us. All of us together do not have that kind of wisdom. And so I appeal to you as our risen Lord did in the third of Revelation in his letter to the church at Laodicea. A church which said, I am rich, don't need anything, don't even need God. We've got stained glass windows, a full bank pipe organ, and a robe choir, and a good looking preacher, and all that kind of stuff. We don't know what we need God for. Got plenty of money. And yet Jesus said, what you don't know is that while you've got plenty of clothing, you're naked as a jaybird. And while you make collyrium eye salve for your eyes, you're just as blind as a bat. Why don't you come to me and live? And why, my friends, I'm very sure as I stand before you that the Crestwood congregation does not fall in that category. Yet we all need to be warned, lest in self-complacency and indifference, we fall into that position of really not living our lives under the Lordship of Christ, but really living according to our own selfish desires. But I remind you, to close with a more joyful note, that it was that Laodicean church, no count as you please, it's that church that Jesus says, whom I love, I chasten. I stand at the door of your hearts and keep knocking. And if you will open the door and let me come in, I'll be your Lord. And this is my plea, that the Crestwood congregation not yield to summertime temptations and wintertime temptations, whatever they are, but that we remember that the one who died for us has placed us under eternal obligation and privilege to live for him, so that when we die, we'll have nothing to do but to die and to be with him. I stand at the door of your heart and keep knocking. Will you really let him in? And I must let him in.